The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 391 for Monday, April 9th, 2012.
Good evening, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips, we send in our answers, we send in our tips. Well, we don't actually send them in. We provide them here, don't we? And together we all learn something new. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And tomorrow I'm going to be in Princeton, New Jersey, as I mentioned on a couple of previous episodes. Tomorrow, well, I should be clear, tomorrow the 10th, which, you know, depending on when you hear this, maybe yesterday the 10th or 4 days ago the 10th or today the 10th even. I'm going to be in Princeton, New Jersey. Speaking at PMUG, the Princeton Mac Users Group, all about home networking. So that should be fun. I get to fly to your favorite airport, John, Philadelphia.
The one that I got stuck in year before.
A year ago, Macworld, right?
Not this Macworld, but the one prior. Yes. Yes. They had a horrible ice storm, and my plane got grounded. Yep.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I'll take some pictures. Take some pictures and send them to you so you can relive. Is there a particular couch that that you were more fond of than others?
I actually lounged in one of the they have rocking chairs in parts of the place. So rather than the hard bench, the rocking chair was probably the best. I mean, the staff was nice. They provided people with blankets.
Nice.
And it's not a bad airport.
Well, other than the fact that it gets shut down, that, like, you know, the mere sight of like wind or something.
But, no, this was a bad storm.
No, I know. Mean, but Philly is like shut down all the time. It's like they don't try to like do anything there. It's just like, oh, there might be some weather. Let's shut it down. It's like nobody connects through. So.
And I learned that, too. So this year, of course, I think I transferred in Atlanta.
There you go.
Much less of a chance of having an ice storm January shut it down. But no, it was all right. The cool part was the de-icing robots are awesome. It's almost like Transformers. I got some nice pictures of those. And they have some nice artwork there and nice amenities. But yeah, I mean, by the time they shut everything down, there were no hotels. There were no cabs. It was just sleep in the airport. And I hope that's the first and last time I ever sleep overnight in. And then they misdirected my bag.
Well, that was the other bonus. Some guy that looks like John Candy could have come up and offered you a ride in his car, and you could have started down a whole adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles.
It was enough of an adventure, especially since I eventually figured out through the magic of my, I had my computer, my Clear device, and I actually suggested to them a itinerary that would get me out of there because they pretty much left everybody on their own. And I think I did Philly to Texas to Arizona to Oakland. And I'm like, yeah, I found a flight here. Can you book me on this? And they're like, yeah, hold on. And they're like, yeah, whatever. I mean, they're probably losing money on the whole thing. But it's like so the strategy is rather than you waiting on the phone and you hoping that they're going to find an itinerary, you should, if you have internet connectivity, you should be able to find your own. And I did. And it worked out. But again, my bag didn't make it.
Flight Track Pro, right? Is that the one that I use? I'm trying to find it on my iPhone here. But if you use TripIt, that can find alternate flights, and yeah, Flight Track can also make finding alternate paths there much easier. So yeah, so 7 o'clock tomorrow night, I will be in Princeton, and if you're there, it'd be great to see you. All right, let's dive right in here, John. You want me to read this Brad one before you start with it, or are you going to read Brad's thing?
I got it right in front of me, so I will kick it off. So Brad writes, "My wife gave me her Lion iMac to use in my office. I changed the username and password, but she still says she sees her computer active on the web. The question is, how can I get rid of everything that relates to her account and get rid of her software without reinstalling Lion and Parallels?" And this is a multifaceted question here, so I'm going to identify one of the facets of what I think is still left over. and we're going to bounce this back and forth, Dave. Because it sounds like a simple question, but I don't think it is. I think it gets quite deep. So here's one thing that I identified or I interpreted still sees computer active on the web. One place which you may want to look where there may be information left over that changing. So first off, I think what happened here is that he went to accounts, highlighted the account in question, and I think there's that field that says full name. So as far as I can tell, what happened is that value was changed. Do you think that's happened here?
I don't know what happened. So I may have hazard a guess. Yeah, there are various things where you need to go and look. What it sounds like happened is what you're saying, that this person did not, Brad inherited the computer from his wife, but he kept her user account as opposed to creating a new user account. And I think, frankly, that would alleviate many, though not all, of the potential, problems or lingering bits of data. So yeah, potentially it just changed the long username, as we call it. But of course the short username, which is used by the operating system, is buried underneath. But yeah, assuming that he kept the user account the same and just changed its name, then yeah, there's going to be lots of little things to change. For example,
so one of the little things that I identified, and I think would be left over if you did this, so I interpreted as seeing computer active on the web that his wife still saw that machine accessing websites. And a lot of websites will do this, especially financial ones or others, will identify the last time that they saw a certain account access it. So that was one way I interpreted this statement. And here's where you want to look to try... to clean up that data, is that in Safari, now we talked about password managers, but Safari has what I guess I call a very basic password manager. And if you go to Safari in the preferences and you go to autofill, there's going to be a number of selections. One of them is username and passwords. And Safari will certainly offer, if you have that box checked, will offer to save username and passwords to websites that you go to. So one thing I suggested is you want to go to that section of the preferences and then click on edit, and there will be a selection saying remove all. So that's one of many places where there's data left over that, just because you change the username, that, as far as I know, that data is not going to change. It's going to stay there. So, and actually any of the autofill data you may want to go to and then check it out and clear that out. So that was one suggestion I had for a place he'd like to look to clean up. And then you have another one.
I do. I actually, and I might even have a better way of doing that, John, because there's lots of stuff that Safari is going to keep. And if you're maintaining the same user account, to clean out Safari, the best thing to do is to go to launch Safari and go to the Safari menu and then choose reset Safari. And you're going to see, I don't know, 8 or 10 checkboxes there. And you probably want to at least look at each one and perhaps check most of them. So that's
brilliant. That is actually a choice in that dialogue. I just saw it. Remove saved names and passwords is one of the checkboxes in the reset Safari, which, yeah, it's reset Safari ... And I see 10 things there. Okay. That is, I think, a better way to, good call. That's a better way to reset Safari to its virgin state.
Yep. But so really, though, unless you have some very, very specific reason that you want to maintain the same user account, I would say wipe out the user account or just create a new one and start fresh with that one. That's going to make life a lot easier for you. But there's one place that even if you do that, the computer will still appear as active. Now, that's going to be in, if you go to System Preferences and go to Sharing, at the very top of that window is computer name. Now, if this was named, Brad's wife's computer, whatever her name is, then that's still going to appear in the Finder sidebar and other sharing places on other machines that appear on that same network. So changing the name there does in fact make things a little bit easier to delineate what computer is where. And that might be what she's talking about. She might be seeing that in like the Finder sidebar. But I would So I'm trying to think if, taking Brad's specific case out of this, as we're looking at a computer, you know, there's a lot of opportunities where many of us repurpose computers for other family members. So, you know, privacy and security and even deleting apps and licensing and all that, those concerns apply less than they would if you were repurposing it to sell, say, to, you know, either even a friend or someone you don't know on eBay or Craigslist or whatever. So, certainly changing the computer name when doing that, you may not want to wipe out all your applications, but that makes good sense. But that would be one place. The other place would, again, I'll say it, create a new account for yourself. Depending on what you're doing, you might want to archive your Time Machine backups. And by archive, I mean take the backup and save it off and then start a new one so that you've got a Time Machine backup that sort of is frozen in time from when your wife stopped using the computer. And then you've got one from when you started. That would be another thing. I'm trying to think off the top of my head of any other places where you'd want to go and tweak settings. Mail. Would be yet another one. You probably don't want to have your wife's email coming on your computer. And so, again, if you've got a backup set off to the side, then you can just go into mail and accounts and remove all of her accounts from there and then add yours in. I'm trying to think. Other place, well, iCloud or MobileMe, depending on what operating system you're using and how you're doing it. But log her out of that. And then log you in.
That's actually in the accounts dialogue as well.
Mm.
So in addition to full name, which you can change the MobileMe username associated with the admin account.
Yeah, but that doesn't change it for the, that changes it for like login and find my, and back to my Mac. But that, I don't think that changes it for the syncing and all that. In order to change it there, you have to go into either the iCloud or, if you're still using it, the MobileMe preference pane and also change it there. The two are not the same. I don't think I'm mistaken on that one. I think you can have one account in one place and another in another, and the system's okay with that. So any other stuff, or are we good on Brad? If you folks come up with anything, let us know.
I think we're as good as we can be. So would it be safe to say that creating a new account is probably a good place to start in a case like this?
I've said it twice. I'll agree again.
So absolutely. Say it again.
Yeah. Create a new account. That's the easiest
so,
way.
So trying to repurpose the old account by just changing the name of it is you're going to have a lot of cruft come over.
Yeah.
But if you create the new account, then you shouldn't lose any of the apps that are already installed. And I think that's the goal here, is to benefit from the software that was already purchased and installed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Cool. All right. Going on to Austin, not the town of Austin. Oh, actually, wait a minute. Yeah. The person Austin writes, "Hi, Dave and John. I have a first gen iPad with iOS 5. I have seen all the commercials and YouTube videos that have iDevices with iOS 5 on them, and in Notification Center, they have Yahoo widgets for weather and stock. However, my iPad does not have them. I've watched various YouTube videos and have not found a solution. Can you help?" Okay, so what Austin's talking about here is if you swipe down into the Notification Center, which is the swiping down from the menu bar there in iOS 5, you will see the weather for your current location, and you'll see a little stock ticker. And those are, as Austin said, little widgets that can be put into Notification Center. But they're called weather widget and, I believe, stock widget. Yeah. Here's the thing. They only work on the iPhone and iPod Touch. There are no widgets, weather or stock or otherwise, available for the iPad. So that's why you're not able to do it. It has nothing to do with what model iPad you have. Those of us with the new iPad 3s or whatever you want to call the third gen iPad, I can't do it either. So, but if you are on an iPhone, and again, this now doesn't help Austin, but may help the rest of you. You can manage this by going into settings, notifications, and then you'll see you can sort apps manually or by time. And then below that, you've got in notification center, and it lists all of the apps and widgets that are configured to be in notification center. And if you scroll through that list at the bottom of that, you'll see the end of the list and then the start of a new list labeled not in notification center. So if you want your weather widget to be removed from notification center, you can move it down below into that second list. And you do that by hitting the edit button. And then you get little sliders where you can grab the various apps and move them down. So you can rearrange your apps that way. And you can also choose what's going to appear in notification center and what isn't. So yeah, unfortunately, there are no weather or stock widgets for the iPad. I'm actually not sure why, but that's the way it is. So you're not missing anything that the rest of us have, Austin. No, you're missing everything that the rest of us don't have, if that makes sense. So you're in good company. Perhaps that's the right way to say it. Okay. All right. Let's go to the phones.
Hey, John and Dave. Brad from West Michigan. Got a bit of a problem here. I'm hoping you can help me out with. It's kind of an odd one. I use a piece of software called Paragon HFS Plus for Windows, and it allows me to view my Mac drives on my Windows 7 machine. What's going on here is if I format an external hard drive from my Mac as a Mac Extended Journal GUID partition scheme drive, stick it over on the Windows 7 PC, it works great. I can see it, I can read, I can write to it, the whole nine yards. But I cannot get a flash drive to do the same. I format, let's say, an 8 gig flash drive the same way that I do my external hard drive, and I bring it on over to the Windows PC, and it won't mount it. I go into Disk Manager, and oddly enough, the drive shows up as a 200 meg EFI healthy, I believe. The rest of it shows as basically a FAT32. It says FAT32. And then there's like 120 some meg of unallocated space at the end of the drive. It's just really odd. I just don't understand what my Mac is doing differently to these thumb drives than it would be to these external drives. I have tried connecting them, like connecting my external drive via FireWire or USB. It works in both instances. My thumb drives, I've tried three different thumb drives. They all have the same results. None of them will work at all. My Mac can read the thumb drives fine and plays nice with them, but bringing them over to my Windows 7 machine, just can't handle them. The only other thing that I have tried is I installed a Mac OS X server, I think it was Snow Leopard server, as a virtual machine on my Mac, and I tried the same things with formatting a flash drive and formatting a hard drive, and again with the same results. Flash drives, no go. External hard drives work fine. So any suggestions or help you can give me, this one's got me baffled. I'd really appreciate it. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thanks, Brad. All right, John, let me set this up for you just a little bit here. To confirm, I checked out Paragon Software's website, and sure enough, HFS Plus for Windows 9 will at least reportedly support USB devices. So I would assume that means flash drives. Off you go.
You set it up. I'm going to knock them down.
Okay.
I think I know what's happening here, Dave. And okay. I think the important part here is we want to make a distinction between two different parameters that can be applied to any storage device. And that is the partition map scheme. And then the format of the partition. Okay?
Okay, yeah.
And I actually tried this, and the thing is, so for the most part, now I have, due to trade shows, as you probably do, I have a bucket of USB drives. And for the most part, every one that I've gotten, I think for good reason, comes with a partition map scheme, which is master boot record.
Right. And which is the default on the Windows side.
Correct. And the thing is, for the Mac has no problem reading USB drives. And I think that's why people do it, is because it can bop between, as long as you're running a modern operating system, it can be read by both Macs and PCs and Unix machines. You know, sure. Almost any machine can understand that partition map scheme. What I think's happening here is that we're getting a combination of a drive that has a partition map scheme that is master boot record, but has as the format Mac OS extended. And I think that's where I believe, and we should check with them, and I'm sure they'll get back to us on this, but I believe what's happening is that the software is getting confused because it's seeing a weird mix, and that it's seeing master boot record and Mac OS extended. So to be clear again, we want to differentiate. You have a partition map scheme, and how do you get to that? Well, when you highlight, so in disutility, you're going to see typically two levels of granularity. You're going to see the device itself, and if you click on partition, and actually if you want to change it, and I actually did this with one of my flash drives, so I stuck it in, it showed up as a, you know, 16 gigabyte, blah, 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 whatever. I then went to the partition tab,
right,
and then I clicked changed it. So it'll say volume scheme current, and then you can click on that. And so I did the very simplest thing, which I said, okay, well, create one partition. Basically, of course, this will destroy all the data. And then there's an options button below that. And if you click on the options button, that will show you the three different partition schemes. And the one that I put in there came up as master boot record, and then it offered GUID, and then the other one is
Apple File System.
Apple File System, which is the one that is more appropriate for, I believe, Motorola Macs. But GUID is what you should be using for Intel-based Macs. So I think what you want to try to do is first repartition as GUID. Then, once that happens, then go to the drive that's been created and then click on Erase. And when you click on Erase, you're then going to be asked for the format.
Yeah, I'll buy that. So you think it's a mismatch in the partition map versus the partition type and partition format. And though the Mac is fine with it, you think that there's something about Paragon's utility that gets tripped up by it. And that makes sense to me.
Yeah. And as far as I saw, it was funny because when I repartitioned as GUID, the format was still MS-DOS. So the thing is, these are two independent values, which you can have, as far as I can see, you can mix and match them any way you want. You can have whatever valid partition scheme is offered by disutility along with any format. And, you know, let's be clear, these are two distinct values, but I think you can mix and match them. And so what I'm thinking is Paragon is seeing a combination that doesn't really make sense. And so it's not dealing with it properly. Well, once I took my flash drive, so I was able to repartition it as GUID and then reformat it as HFS, and it shows up as that now. Before, it showed up as FAT32 and master boot record, and that was fine. Or FAT16. I don't know if it was FAT16 or FAT32. What, one or the other?
Yeah. So that actually this makes sense. But this makes me ask the question: why would you? All these flash drives, like you said, come formatted with FAT, either FAT32 or FAT16 or what, you know, whatever works for the drive.
And master boot record.
And master boot record.
They seem to work fine on the Mac.
Yeah.
You can read, you can write, everything's great.
Yeah, exactly. So my question would be, the drives aren't big enough, at least not yet, where size of blocks and all that stuff really matters. Why would one want to change the format of their flash drive to HFS Plus, knowing full well that now makes it a less usable drive in terms of being portable to, you know, take files back and forth to Windows machines and that sort of thing. I've never found a compelling reason to reformat my flash drives as anything other than FAT.
I mean, the only thing I've seen is that I believe if your setup is master boot record and FAT, I believe the only limitation is naming of the volume.
Well, and you're
somewhat limited,
and you can't boot from it.
Right.
Right.
Right. Because Mac won't boot from it. But I think you're limited. I forget how many characters, but you're limited in how long and what characters you can use to in the name of the volume, I believe, is a limitation of just name master boot record and FAT.
Name of the volume. I think that's right. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Okay.
But other than that, yeah, I think you can all other operations as far as, you know, the name of the files and things like that. So that's my guess, is you got a wacky combination here. So get this utility, pop it in there, look at the top level, look at the partition scheme, then click on the drive itself, see what that is. And my guess is that it's going to be a odd combination.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Cool.
Think so?
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Barebones Software, of course, at barebones.com with BB Edit. Now, BB Edit, I'll give a quick overview, and then we actually got a letter from a listener that I want to read. But BB Edit is a text editor, and it really is kind of the end all be all of text editors. You can, if you have any text you need to edit, be it code, you could do C stuff with this. You can do HTML with this, PHP, really any language that you can think of. They've already thought of it. And you know, it'll do. I've talked about a couple of things here in the past, but one thing, I was doing some PHP the other day, and one thing that's really cool, and this would, I'm sure, would happen in any language, but you know, I defined a variable, and then later on I was typing and I needed to recall that variable. And so I hit $, and I don't know if the variable's name was test, right? I hit $T and it came up with like a little autocomplete thing, and it said test, you know, and I just hit tab and boom, it autocompleted my variable. It'll do that with function names. It'll do that with PHP. I was actually writing a script using curl. And so there's all these different curl options, curl being a way of interacting with web pages from within PHP. And you can use it actually in many different languages, but I was using it in PHP. And so there's all these different little curl options you can set. Well, it knew about all of them. So as I type curl_, it gave me a laundry list of stuff, and I could just pick from it and say, oh yeah, that's it. And now I know exactly how to format it and all of that. So it really, it's quite something. And I want to take a minute to read a note from listener Chris. He says, I was thinking it would be cool to add value to the marketing of BB Edit by having a different BB Edit cool tip each episode as a part of the ad itself. When you run out of tip ideas, perhaps you could solicit listener BB Edit tips. So consider the solicitation window open. Happy to take this stuff in. And Chris says, for example, I just thought of this one. When you want to populate the lyrics of an iTunes track's metadata, often you turn to a Google search to find the lyrics first. If you've ever done this, you may have noticed that the more popular sites tend to do just about everything they can to prevent you from copying and pasting. However, with Safari's debug menu enabled, you can right-click on the lyrics and choose Inspect Element, a super useful web development tool, or simply view the source code and copy and paste the HTML into BB Edit. Then in BB Edit, select All, Markup, in the Markup menu, go to tidy, and then say convert HTML to text. This will remove all the HTML markup, leaving you just the lyrics there ready to copy and paste into iTunes. I mentioned the inspect element approach because you can more quickly drill in on the parent element of the lyric section than right click on that element and choose copy as HTML. Plus, it's relatively easy to find the lyrics surrounding element because Safari highlights the selected HTML with a blue overlay. Awesome. Thanks, Chris. And yeah, BB Edit makes it easy. If you've got a block of HTML, it could be lyrics. It could really be anything. But you want to strip the HTML out of, that's yet another use for BB Edit. So BB Edit from Barebones Software. You can check it all out and get a free trial at barebones.com. But it's only $50. It's actually it's $49.99 to buy, and you can buy it on the Mac App Store as well if you like. So really, go check it out, get the free trial, and you're good to go. Were you just coughing, John, or did you have something to add?
Sorry.
Oh, no problem. Yeah. So yeah, BB Edit from barebones.com. And with that, John, you ready to read Rob's comment here?
You know, you think I wasn't, but I am.
All right.
So here we go. And yes, in my own style here. Hi, Pilot Pete, Dave, and John. Oh, that makes me sad. From Rob. I'm going to assess about this. Hey, you let me read, and this is what you get, Dave, all right?
I know. Hey, it's good.
So here we go. This is an interesting one. I think we're going to toss this around. So my roommate has got a new MacBook Pro and wants to use the hybrid HDD she had in her old MacBook Pro in the new MacBook Pro. Simple enough, I think. Here are the specs for the new and the old MacBook Pro and the HDDs. I don't think I need to read these.
By HDDs, you mean hard disks.
Hard disk drive.
That's right.
Okay, which even though it's this is a hybrid drive, we'll call it a hard disk drive. So yeah, HDD is shorthand for hard disk drive. Well, now we're also all systems are running OS X Lion 10.7.3. The old MacBook is a mid-2009 2.66 gigahertz dual core with the Seagate Momentum XT hybrid 500 gig drive. The new MacBook Pro is a late 2011 2.4 gigahertz i7 with 4 gigabytes with a Toshiba MK blah, blah, blah. Drive. The problem is that when we install the hybrid HDD in the new MacBook Pro, we get 3 beep tones when we try to install OS X Lion on the new hard disk drive. The hybrid HDD is formatted to Mac OS X journaled, connected to a Mac Mini via USB. When we try to install Snow Leopard on the hybrid HDD, we get a no access sign, which you know we've probably all seen, which is a symbol with a line through it. Which is bad. We have upgraded the firmware of the hard drive from SD26 to SD28, which I confirmed is the latest version. But this has no effect in the new MacBook Pro. We hope you guys have a solution for us to get the hybrid HDD working in the new MacBook Pro. This is from Norway. Well, that's cool. All right. Didn't know we had listeners far and wide, yeah, even in Norway. Yeah. So my first reflection here, Dave, is the thing that concerned me here was the mention of 3 beeps. Now, I'm going to go with, well, I don't know. You know, now reading this, I'm not sure if this is what's happening here. But
welcome to my world. You know, it's funny because
as I read it over, I wasn't sure if
your previously thought of solution is the right one. Happens to me all the time.
Or what I found. But here's the thing.
Talk about the 3 beeps. Go.
Well, the 3 beeps, so what happens is that the Mac, like almost any computer, performs what is known as a post or power on self test, which just checks out the hardware and just makes sure that everything's in at least a good enough state where the machine can try to start up. Now, hearing this statement, 3 beeps, there is an article here, which we will, of course, link to, which if you try to start up your Mac and you hear 3 beeps, what this means, based on this article here from Apple, is that the machine could not find any good banks of memory.
That's bad.
Okay. And most of these beep codes here, actually, I'm looking at this. So you can get 1 to 5 beeps. So if you start up your Mac and you hear any number of beeps, it could either mean no RAM, incompatible RAM, no good banks, no good boot image in the boot ROM, which, yeah, that's bad, too. Or processor is not usable if you get 5 beeps, which is like, whoa. So I'm trying to think why trying to plug this drive in, because, I mean, it is a SATA drive. I mean, it should be. And looking at this model of Mac, I mean, I looked at this and this the newer Mac to install the hard drive. It looks like what you have to do is you have to take the screws out of the lower cover. So it's not one of the Macs where you can just pull off the access door for the battery and replace the hard drive. That was nice when they did that. But this Mac, if you pull off all the screws on the bottom and you pull up the cover, it looks like the hard drive is directly accessible and you should just be able to pull it out and put in the new one. So I'm kind of scratching my head here why you would get the 3 beep RAM error putting in the new one, other than you may have... I mean, looking at this RAM on this machine, I mean, it's kind of hard to get to. I don't know if, I mean, I'm hoping something can get zapped or something got, you know, knocked out. I mean, I don't know if you want to reseat the RAM here. I mean, that was one of my thoughts, but reading this again, I'll toss it to you, my esteemed colleague.
Yeah.
I mean, 3 beeps. I mean, what does 3 beeps mean? I mean, to me, 3 beeps, what outside of a power on self test?
Well, it depends on when these 3 beeps are happening. If they're happening, you know, if you shut down the machine, you replace the drive and then started it back up and immediately you get the three beeps, then yeah, that's part of the power on self test. And it means, like you said, no RAM or bad RAM. Now, that could have been that you unseated the RAM while you were digging in there, or like John said, you could have fried something. But if you've gotten it to power up to the Lion, you know, startup DVD, or actually there is no Lion startup DVD. So if you've got a USB drive to boot from, I don't know how you're trying to install Lion, but if it's able to boot from something, then it gets a little more curious. That's where we scratch our heads. Now, as far as not being able to install Snow Leopard on the hybrid, if it already has Lion on it, then yeah, you're not going to be able to install Snow Leopard as a normal install. You'd have to do an erase and install, because Snow Leopard doesn't downgrade from Lion. That makes sense. But if the three beeps are happening as the Lion installer is running, that's really weird. And I'm guessing that's not what you're telling us here, but it is possible that that's what's happening. So, in that case, I would run Disk Utility first and format the drive. Now, obviously, you need to make sure you have a backup of whatever data was on there. But if that's actually happening from within the installer, you can go and run Disk Utility, and then from there, you just wipe the drive clean and now start from scratch with a fresh install of Lion. That's where I would go with this. And that, you know, if it is something wacky about what was the data or the installation that was previously on the drive, that's going to go ahead and wipe it all out and let you start from scratch. So those are my thoughts on that. I don't know that we have anywhere to go on this one, but that's,
well, the only other thought I would have is, and it kind of relates to the flash drive thing, but I would just make double sure that the hybrid drive is partitioned and formatted in the right format here. I'm wondering if the newer machine is more sensitive to that sort of mismatch. So just make sure it's possible. GUID and it's HFS plus. The other thought is, I mean, this would eliminate a problem with, you know, like what we suspected zapping the machine is maybe putting this drive, if you do have one, and if you don't have one, you may want to get one, maybe putting that drive in an external enclosure and see if you can install the OS on that. Yeah. But, to me, what that would eliminate is a problem with the hardware, some flakiness in the hardware in the machine itself. I mean, you certainly should be able to do that. If you boot from a DVD or, you know, Lion installer, you should be able to install to a FireWire or USB drive that's connected to that machine. So that's the other thought I have.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, we'll have to wait to see and hear back.
Yeah. You know, I want to try one of these. I think I'm going to approach, I don't know if I'm want to lay out the cash here being a cheapskate or approach Seagate and say, you know what, you should, you know, because we just got done with, you know, I reviewed the Samsung.
Right.
470 series SSD, which
I'd be curious.
Is a screamer. I mean, it's a screamer, though for my taste, it's a bit pricey, and I don't think.
I thought you had already checked out one of these Momentous drives.
No, I had not. I've been considering it. So I've checked. So I checked out the 470 series, excellent drive. You know, smoking fast. Even though my MacBook Pro is only SATA 1, you know, it's crippled. Sure. I tried in the Mini, and oh boy. I mean, it screamed. Because also I bought the Mini with, like, you know, the bargain basement Toshiba drive that Apple offers.
Right.
And it was like night and day. So it definitely made the Mini a screamer. But no, I want to try them because I've heard isolated reports of people having issues, and maybe it's due to this old firmware with the Momentous XT. And actually, I did check, Dave. So you and I had been wondering about the RAM in this drive, and I confirmed that the RAM in this is, in fact, flash memory.
That's what I figured.
The big RAM buffer. Yeah, I thought it may have been static, but it's not. No, I looked at the specs for the drive. The other thing I was thinking here is that, to wrap this up, is that I looked at the power requirements for this drive. And as far as I can tell, the power requirements for this drive, I think I saw it, the wattage that it drew, because I was thinking, I wonder if this drive is drawing too much juice and causing some trauma for this machine that it's being put into.
Sure.
But this drive doesn't really draw too many more watts than your standard, you know, I think it was around 2 watts or something like that. But I looked at the spec sheet and it didn't seem to be out of line with what a regular rotational hard drive would draw. So,
okay. All right.
But well, the beeps are
weird. Yeah. All right. So, we obviously, 2 weeks ago, if I'm doing my math right, we did, kind of a big focus on backups. And, as we promised, we've now consolidated all of your feedback from that and we'll run through that and pretty much probably use that to wrap up the rest of the time that we've got for today's show. So we will start. Some of the stuff is just backups in general. And then some of it, of course, is some clarification questions that we had, that we wanted to readdress from the specific episode that we did. So we'll start with Mark, who has a very generic question about backups. He says, I'm a longtime listener with a problem that I'm hoping you can help me with. Our church recently had a break-in and all our computers were stolen. None of them had backups. Knowing that I'm somewhat of a geek, my pastor asked me for some help. The insurance company responded quickly and all the computers were replaced with new Macs. Though no one had backups, there were several individuals had iPhones or iPads with more or less updated contact lists, address books, etc. The issue is, of course, that I don't know of a way to restore the information on these new computers. Hooking up the iDevices to the computers would erase the data. Other than manually copying over the information, is there any way to get the information from these devices onto our new computers? So this is something that we've certainly talked about before. And I see that there's three ways to do this. Did we answer this question on the show or did we just prep it earlier, John? It sure sounds like something that we've gone through very specifically, but, no, John.
Maybe
hard to tell. Okay. So I will run through it anyway. It's good to remember. So the first thing that you can do is you can take an iDevice and connect it to any Mac and it'll say, if it tries to auto sync, it'll say, it's got to wipe it out. Don't let it do that. Hit cancel, but leave it connected. And in iTunes, you can go and right click on the device in kind of the iTunes sidebar there and choose backup. This will shoot a backup of that device onto your Mac. So that's one place to start. So at least as you muck around and try and get data off, if you happen to screw up, you've at least got a backup of this device with all of its data, at least that it has on it. Once you've done that, there's a couple things to think about. Number one, if you've been using iCloud, well, that's a very easy way to sync your contacts and that sort of thing back down to your Mac, right? Because it's all just up there in the cloud. You don't even have to worry about the device. Just sync your Mac up with iCloud and you're good to go. Number two would be using a piece of software called PhoneView from Ecamm Networks. And of course, we'll put a link in the show notes. You can get a demo, but it is $20. Well worth it, whether or not you have this specific problem, folks. PhoneView is awesome for manipulating data on your iOS devices and getting data off. So you can pull off your contacts and things like that. Very, very handy. And then the other thing, if you've done the backup that we mentioned, you can use something called iPhone Backup Extractor from iPhoneBackupExtractor.com. That's $24.95, so $5 more. But it does things similar to PhoneView, but in a different way because you're manipulating the data from your backup and you can pull things off of that. So those would be kind of my places to start with those. And, it's, you know, there is an endless supply of very interesting backup-related questions, and I thought this was a good one to start with. Any thoughts, John, before we move on to Andrew?
No.
All right, then. Well, then we'll move to Andrew. Andrew writes, I have a late 2006 17-inch MacBook Pro, which died recently due to a failed motherboard. I don't have the money to replace it just yet, so I needed another Mac to keep me going in the interim. Luckily, I have a mid-2011 17-inch MacBook Pro from my employer that I use for work. My backup strategy includes Time Machine, a monthly clone backup, and a Dropbox account, which is synced with all of my important documents and projects, not including iTunes and iPhoto libraries. At the time of failure, my Time Machine and Carbon Copy Cloner backups were about 3 weeks and 1 week old, respectively. As I needed to work on some stuff quickly and didn't have time to pull apart my broken laptop, my initial course of action was to create a second account on my company machine, hook it up to my Dropbox account. This worked fine and quickly gave me access to my current data set. Smart, right? We talked about that in the backup episode, right, John? You know, part of this is saving time and the Dropbox syncing is a great way. If you've got your documents out there, it's a great way to get right back up and running. SugarSync works, well, you know, same
and
way.
Not only that, but as we talked about, single point of failure. Do not have any of your important, and he said it's important,
yep.
Don't have it in just one place. And I think Dropbox is an excellent solution for that sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. He says, it was around a week before I had time to remove the hard drive from my old machine, but by this time I had changed a large number of files. So the only thing that I could think of was to manually copy the missing bits of data, iTunes, iPhoto, etc., not included in my Dropbox backup to my new user account. Smart. Now I know that just because my new user is the same name as the old account on my old machine, it doesn't mean anything from a permissions perspective. Also, the fact that the account on my company machine was the second account to be created rather than the first on my old machine can also cause permission problems. Very smart. But in my position now that I have everything working fine, I have all the data on my company machine, I have a couple of questions. Number one, in a perfect world, despite my admittedly very messy recovery path, hey, that's not messy. It's you know, you got to get back up and running and then worry about kind of the long term. So I think this is not it may be messy, but it's certainly not uncommon. So he says, I'd like to retain the time machine history from my old machine as part of a new time machine backup of my company machine. Despite closely following instructions that we'll post in the thing, he says, I can get the first dialog, which offers to let me use the old disk, but I'm unable to actually get it to work. Number two, the data on my company machine now comes from two sources, my Dropbox backup and the stuff I copied from my old hard drive. Everything works, so there are no massive issues. But when I want to access data that has come from my old hard drive, I get prompted to enter my account password. I know why this has happened and accept that my messy recovery caused it, but I'd like to know if there's a way to get to reset permissions on everything under my user folder so I don't get the error and whether doing so would create further problems. Okay. So let's go to number one here. So with his time machine backup that he wants to preserve, I really think that you're barking up the wrong tree with that. I get that there's on paper you want to do that, but I think it's a bad idea for a lot of reasons. Number one, that's your only backup. So you're now doing something that Apple doesn't support or recommend, and you may wind up blowing away the one backup that you have of that old machine, right? So I would archive that off and start a new backup because you're talking about doing a time machine backup. You're not even doing it from a clone of the machine that originally made it. You're doing it from a completely different machine that happens to have some of the same user account data in a second user account. It's going to be a train wreck. And most of what you have on the old backup is going to not be relevant. So I think you save that off and start a new time machine backup. I think otherwise you're crazy. Honestly, you're gonna get yourself into a real world of hurt. It sounds like you disagree. I hear you clucking and huffing over there. So
I was
tell
not
us.
Clucking. Oh, I didn't. Okay. I have not clucked.
All right. Well,
during this episode, though, I may. But I'm with you in that. Well, on the one hand, when I recently did an upgrade to my MacBook. Yeah, when I got the new drive, you know what I did, Dave? I did try to force my machine to see the old backup. And as pointed out, there are ways, though Apple, it seems, makes it more and more difficult. I mean, you got to change UUIDs and GUIDs and all of these values that are in hidden files and stuff. And, you kind of get the hint that Apple is really, unless they offer you the option, which sometimes they do, they'll come up and say, hey, I saw an old time machine backup. You want me to glom onto this or you want me to start a new one? One thing that occurs to me is that, if you do go to time machine and you right click or control click on it, it'll offer you the option browse other time machine disks. And I'm wondering if I think what you were suggesting is you store that old one off somewhere. Yeah. You should still be able to access it if you need to. But at some point, and we've seen this, both you and I have seen this, like I recently had this happen where my time machine got corrupted, even though it's stored on the Drobo and I trust the Drobo is storing the data properly. Well, I have my doubts, a little tangent here. I actually had my doubts here because I had some media files recently with a VLC update freak out. I'm like, what is going on here? There were old real media files that I wanted to keep. And I tried to play them with the recent version of ELC and they didn't play back properly. I'm like, oh no, is my Drobo freaking out? No. And another weird tangent here. So apparently VLC, the newer VLC, is doing some weird things with Real Media files, because I actually found a new version of the Real Media player, and it played them back fine. So that made me happy that my data was not being corrupted. It was the latest VLC update. Apparently they made some changes to their Real Media codec, which didn't work with some of the files that I had. But
that's good to know. I mean, I realize it's a, you know, tangent from a tangent, but that is actually really good.
Well, no,
good
I ran tip. Into it. That's I was good. Freaking out again. I was seeing data that played with an old application and all of a sudden didn't.
Right.
I mean, it was coming up with scrambled data in the playback window. And I'm like, wait, what is going on here? Is the data getting corrupted? Because we've heard of isolated cases where the Drobo doesn't necessarily flash the red light when something's going wrong.
Yes.
You know, just like any drive. Sure. You know, sometimes it happens, though for the most part, I would say I still trust my Drobo.
Yeah. Yeah, I trust the Drobo.
I have not had any data get destroyed or disappear or anything like that. So we're cool. But yeah, so with what you're saying, yes. So Time Machine can still look at old backups, but I would say yes, starting fresh every now and then is a good thing.
Yeah.
For Time Machine, because
and especially in a situation like this. I mean, again, you're not even talking about, it's not like you restored 100% from that Time Machine backup and now you want to keep dumping things at it. You're coming from a completely different installation. You just don't want to mix and match that. I think it's in for a world of hurt. All right. Number Agreed. Two, so yeah, repairing permissions is an interesting thing, and it's, you know, we all see the repair permissions dialog in Disk Utility, but as we discussed, that only repairs permissions for things that have been installed by Apple through Apple's installer and are Apple things. So it's not going to mess with your user permissions. It's not going to mess with any of that. There's a couple things you can do. Number one, we'll point you to the article, but you can run that terminal-based permissions repair utility that exists in Lion. You have to reboot from the recovery partition in order to do it. But that's probably in your case a great thing to run, because that will repair permissions on your user folder. But if your documents are all mixed and matched permissions, you can just go to your documents folder and go to get info in the finder, go to the file menu and choose get info, and then change the owner and, to make sure it's you and read and write, and then hit the little gear at the bottom and say apply to enclosed items. And that will go through your whole documents folder and kind of reset everything so that it has at least is owned by the same user and you can read and write from it. So that. I think that's the way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. We good to move?
We can't move
back. We can't move backwards. There's no
we
going
could,
back.
But that would just be crazy.
Okay.
Back to the future.
That's right. So Chris writes, I just finished listening to your backup session and wondered what you guys do for your MacBook Pros that have had their super drives replaced by an SSD. Following your example, a few months back, I took the plunge and using the kits from OWC, replaced my optical drive with a Mercury Electra 6 gig SSD, plus upgraded my RAM to 8 gigs. Super fast system now on an early 2009 MacBook Pro. My question is about how you arrange your backup when your SSD startup disk is the Time Machine initializing drive, and yet most of your data is on the old rotational drive. I guess you have to physically choose which folders on which drives you want to back up to Time Machine. What then do you do about cloning your drive? I kept my prior Lion install on my rotational disk, so I can always start up from that and access the majority of the data should my SSD die. Should you do a separate backup from the old drive, or is there a way in SuperDuper and Carbon Copy Cloner to clone more than just the startup drive? Okay, so to be clear, I never did this. Anytime I upgraded to an SSD, I actually replaced the rotational drive. But in my iMac, I have an SSD as a boot drive, and then I also have a rotational drive that I it's much larger and I store a bunch of stuff on. So, but here's the first important thing. For your first question, Time Machine will automatically back up all internal drives unless you specifically exclude them. And you would exclude them by going into System Preferences, Time Machine Options, and you can choose what you want to exclude there. But like for me, everything on my boot disk and everything on the internal drive, the internal rotational drive in the iMac, all gets backed up as part of one comprehensive Time Machine backup of that Mac. So in that sense, I think you're going to be okay. In fact, I have one folder on my rotational drive that's called files not backed up, because there's things that I wind up putting out there, you know, torrent files and this, that, the other. Sometimes I have huge files that I'm moving around and I don't want some Time Machine backup to trigger and try to back up some, you know, 2 gig file that I'm not going to keep and I don't really care about. So that's one thing. As far as cloning, I would say you want to clone both disks, and I think you can set up Carbon Copy Cloner. You just set up two jobs, one to clone one disk and one to clone the other. You know, you want to preserve your ability to boot your Mac in the event of catastrophic failure. And then you want to have a recent enough copy of your work environment. Now, of course, you could use Dropbox like we talked about here, and there's various other things. But I think in the end, yeah, you want to clone it all. Clone whatever you would need to get immediately back to work. And, you know, I think Andrew. I think his example is a great one. You know, he got himself right back to work. And then a week later, here's when he went and, you know, extracted the stuff from his Time Machine backup and sort of rebuilt that system that he had. So think about it from that standpoint. You know, if you lost it all right now, what would you want immediately and what would you want within a week? And then, you know, whatever you want immediately, clone that or Dropbox it or both. So there you go. That's my story, John. You got anything to add there?
I like your story.
That's good. That's good.
You know, and then I think in general, like we said, you know, you should any drive or partition, you should have a backup strategy for each one.
Yep.
You should probably put it in multiple places or use, as we mentioned before, a single point of failure. The important, and that's, I guess to me, the head scratcher or the thing is, you know, what's important to you? You know, to me, like the OS, that to me, that's unimportant.
But it is important because you lose time.
Well, to me, yes, but I don't see it as a game changer in the game of life.
Well, yeah, but if you need to get back,
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, but you have a second machine.
It costs me time, you know, and that's actually a very good point. You know, if we're talking redundancy here, you may want to get, now some people may shake their fist at this statement, but you may want to have, I mean, both you and I, Dave, I mean, I have two Macs or at least two in service. I see both my G4 and my G5, you know, my office here. But you may want to also consider as part of I'm being serious here.
No, this is a good point. Yeah.
As part of a backup plan, you know, what if one of your computers exploded or, you know, the kids dumped juice in it or the gets run over in the driveway or a pet does whatever to it. I don't care what it is. The thing is, at least I have at least two distinct computers. I have my Mac Mini and I have my MacBook Pro. So if one machine fails, and I've had this happen, especially when I had to send the machine in for service, in that I would typically create a backup before I send it off of the contents of one machine onto a drive in the Mac, unlike some other computing platforms, tends to be able to tolerate you taking a backup of one machine and putting it in another machine, and you can work with it as long as it's a recent vintage and you don't do any radical changes in the OS or the hardware platform. And I've done this, you know, when I had to send my MacBook Pro the last time for a repair, I backed up the entire drive and then I ran it off of my Mini.
No, it's
until the machine came back. So
it's
think
a good
about
point.
Redundancy, not only in terms of data, folks, but think about redundancy in terms of maybe you want to or find a place, depending where you live, that you can maybe rent a computer if terrible things happen. So, you know, do a full clone of whatever machines are important to you. And if something terrible happens, you can rent a machine for a week or two or borrow a friend's machine and boot off of that drive until things return to normal.
Yep. Now that's a great, yeah, there's a, you know, we talk about single points of failure, have more than one CPU. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Kevin has a comment and a question.
Hi, Dave. Hi, John. It's Kevin here from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I just got done listening to your episode on backups. One of my favorite topics. I was excited to hear you guys do a whole episode on backups. Really, really enjoyed that. I have a comment for you and actually a question. So my comment is I really like the idea of doing an image of your drive, like you said, Dave, daily. I use a cool piece of software I'm sure you've probably heard of called ChronoSync. And I actually image my drive off. I actually have a schedule that runs, I don't remember how often, it could be once an hour or whatever you set it to be. And the cool part is that on the drive that it makes your image to, anything that is deleted from that backup, it actually puts into an archive folder. So that's pretty cool. So if your drive is changing or you're adding files, whatever, it will actually archive off and just keep a folder clearly labeled archive. So if you happen to delete something, your new image has all those deleted files. So I think that's a really cool feature in ChronoSync. My question for you is when you archive, so you were talking about the difference between a backup and an archive. And so when you do a back or an archive, and you archive off to a hard drive, my question would be, you know, if you're not running that drive a lot, because I do this, I'll archive off to a hard drive, and then I don't run that drive for 6 months or a year. And I don't know if that's a good idea. I've heard you guys talk in the past about hard drives and that it's a good idea to run them every so often and, you know, with magnetic issues with them and stuff like that. So I'm just wondering what you actually back up to for your archive. And if it's a hard drive, do you recommend running that every once in a while? And if so, how often? I'd be curious to hear your answer on that. I love the show. That was a great show on backups, and that was super cool. So keep up the good work. Thanks a lot for listening to my comment. Have a great day.
Thanks, Kevin. Okay, so as far as that thing about ChronoSync creating the archive folder, that's brilliant. I have since learned that Carbon Copy Cloner will also do the same thing if you set it up to. So that can be done with either one of those, which is great. Now, as far as the archives, great question. Yeah, of course, you're right. You don't want to leave a hard drive unpowered sitting on a shelf for more than a couple of months at a time. You do want to spin it up. You do want to access it, read something from it, potentially write something to it. For my archives, and we'll talk about. Well, I'll answer the next question, which we haven't asked right now. Rob asked us, you know, what do you mean by archiving? And to me, an archive is a clone, but it is one that I am never going to modify again. So, and I think Kevin hooked on to that it's something that we're just going to freeze in time and then just sort of leave there. And if we ever need it, we can come back. Now, for me, those archives are disk images stored on my big NAS drive. Right. So that's being accessed constantly. That's my Drobo in most cases. So that's not just sitting there. But yeah, if you're archiving off to a hard disk and then turning it off, turn it on every now and then, connect it up to your machine. And you want to do that once a quarter, I would say, is probably safe. You could probably get away with once every 6 months, but I wouldn't push that. Yeah.
Okay.
Thoughts on that, John? No,
I like that Kevin said it was a super cool episode. That's my thought.
Okay, right. All right, that's good.
No, my thoughts. No, I'm with you. Is that there's been a lot of research and leaving any sort of media in a stagnant or fixed state, like in the same position or not powered up, is probably a bad thing. So yeah, hard drives. Well, any media, as we talked about, Dave, any media will eventually die, but exercising it is always a good thing. So yeah, any backup drive that you have in your backup strategy, you may want to power up for whatever reason.
Well, and there is that whole thing about the Earth's gravitational pull negatively impacting.
Oh, come on, man.
No, we talked about this. Dude, we talked about this like 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
And cosmic rays, huh?
No. Huh? No. Huh? If you leave a hard drive.
I'm being serious in what I said, but go ahead.
No, if you leave a hard drive unpowered and not spinning, what will happen is the gravitational pull of the Earth will actually start to change some of the bits on that drive over time. Now, it will take, you know, a minimum of 6 months for that to begin to happen. And that's why I say you want to spin that thing up. Yeah, this is a known deal, man. I'm surprised you don't remember this. We had a lengthy discussion. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, no, that's a very real thing. That's not tinfoil hat stuff. I like the tinfoil hat stuff, but unfortunately that's not.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you know what I mentioned, though you may chuckle at what I said, but no, there is actually a paper I found here, how cosmic rays cause computer downtime. I'm not kidding, Dave.
Oh, I believe it. Sure.
Well, no, it's radiation. And, right. You know, we've seen this as of late. I think actually about a month ago, there was a big scare because there was a big burst of sunspots or solar radiation that tend to sometimes interfere with satellite and other communication.
Yep.
No, I mean, some people, again, chuckle, but radiation from various sources can affect physical media, including hard drives and all this. So I think it reinforces the point that you brought up is, yeah, you want to exercise whatever media you're using, whether it be a cloud or a hard drive or a flash drive, and just give it a little workout.
Yeah.
So it doesn't get lazy and die.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Where are we? Oh, goodness. Look at the time.
It's time to talk. We'll finish the backups thing because we do have one last comment. Ralph wrote in, and for those of you that listen to Mac Power Users with David Sparks and Katie Floyd, you may have heard this story. But for those of you that haven't, we wanted to share it here as well. Ralph says, being a keen believer in belt and suspenders approach to backups, I listened to your latest review of backup strategies with interest. While the importance of backing up the contents of a computer has not diminished, the tools available to achieving a seamless recovery from a total failure have increased substantially. And with that, here's Ralph's short little story about what I see as kind of the future of backups. And he's got a couple of interesting points. He says, while on vacation earlier this year, my MacBook Pro started to struggle. The Apple Store fix included a nuke and pave of the hard drive, reinstalling the operating system, Lion, and a replacement of the motherboard. So I got a clean sheet, and my external hard drive backup at home was 3,000 miles away. What to do? Number one, I signed into my iTunes account and reinstalled all the software I had purchased from the Mac App Store, including 1Password. I then installed Dropbox and synced 1Password, thereby getting access to all the registration codes I'd stored within the software section of 1Password for all the third-party software I'd purchased. I also recovered and restored my user files backed up on the Dropbox. I then downloaded and reinstalled, re-registered all my third-party software. I then accessed my iCloud account and reinstalled my mail settings, address book, bookmarks, and calendar. I now have 99% of my app software installed and operating. All this took a matter of hours rather than days, as has been my experience doing nuke and paves on my PCs in years gone by. All this was achieved without the benefit of the usual backup tools, Time Machine, bootable clones, etc. None of this could have been achieved without access to the internet, of course, and my cloud-based backup tools, iCloud and Dropbox, as well as an orderly record of software licenses, which he stores in 1Password. Restoring big files, media files, and photos had to wait until he got home. He doesn't subscribe to iTunes Match. He says, I continue to maintain my backup workflow that includes backing up to external hard drives using Time Machine, Carbon Copy Cloner, etc. However, I was surprised at the extent to which I was able to recover without these tools. And again, this speaks to that, you know, multi-tiered strategy. And, you know, of course, he could use something like Dolly Drive or whatever to do remote backups and remote restores. But, you know, as he said, in a matter of hours, he was able to get himself back up and working with the files that mattered. And that's the key. So not only doing your backups, you know, we talked about making sure you know how to restore, but think about how you would restore, because as Ralph found, you know, he had not thought through this particular strategy because he probably never thought he would have to. But as it turned out, he had his stuff pretty much available to him no matter where he was. And that's a cool thing. That's that's what we like to hear. So thanks, Ralph. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks, everybody, for commenting and sending in your tips and all of that good stuff. And I guess we're back in a week. Is that right, John?
A week? You're right.
392 is Monday the not the 9th. So it would be Monday the 16th. Right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. All right, John. So we certainly appreciated all the questions and tips. But now we need to make sure everybody knows how to talk to us. Do you want to start that off, John?
I prefer English. I do know a little Spanish. I'm not sure about your foreign language acumen there, Dave.
I'm pretty much in the same boat as you. My Spanish isn't bad, but my English is better.
Muy bien. So, but I would say the first way that you could reach either of us, and English is our preferred language, that we can try to entertain others, because we have translators. I like Babelfish. Babelfish is fun. But you probably want to send an email, and that's probably the most universal way of communicating with us, and probably the least expensive, and you want to send an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
John, I believe you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And brother, your hearing is impeccable, because I certainly did say feedback@macgeekgab.com.
It's outstanding. You want me to tell them about how to call us, don't you? 206-666-GEEK is the number you can call. And John, Geek is
433 plus 5.
All right, let's go with that. That's good.
I'm trying to think of different ways to mangle that. 4-3-3-5. Or that Geek. Works. I like Geek. I mean, oh, we were so lucky to get that number.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Because I'm a geek, you're a geek. We're all geeks. Or up-and-coming geeks. Or aspiring geeks.
It's all about learning how to be a better geek. That's, you know, that's kind of how it works. We've all got computers. We've all got networks. We've all got backups we've got to manage. So we've got to, you know, at some level,
what else
we
do we have?
Good geek.
Well, we have this other thing. And, you know, there's a bit of controversy here, Dave. I'm going to introduce it. So another way you can reach us, Dave, is that, you know, we opened up this little Facebook page a while ago. And if you want to reach us on Facebook, where you can see, well, we have some chatter. We have some interaction with our beloved user base. Facebook.com/MacGeekGab. Now, the only finger wag I'm going to have here is everybody's all upset that Facebook acquired Instagram. What is up with that? I don't get it, man. I love Instagram. I don't know if I love Facebook, but Facebook is certainly a viable platform. I don't understand why people are all upset about it, but we'll see. So, Facebook.com/MacGeekGab. You will see when we post the show. You will see when we post the show notes, and you can interact with us on our Facebook page. But what else, Dave? There must be more.
There is more. You can find us on Twitter. Twitter.com/MacGeekGab for the show. Twitter.com/John F. Braun for him. Twitter.com/Dave Hamilton for me. That's Twitter. What else do we have?
Wait, what else? There must be more Twitter. Oh, and the band? Oh, did they go on strike?
They did. Gosh. They're back, though. The band's
wow.
Not on Twitter.
Good contract negotiation. What else on Twitter?
Oh, well, we got Pilot Pete, and we have Mac Observer, too.
Ah, there we go. Okay, yeah. Great. The phone number.
We'd like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. He converts this show to AAC for you. You can check out his podcast, though, at wehavecommunicators.com, all about the iPhone and iPad and apps. And he's always got great guests. Adam Christensen and Jeff Gamet are pretty much staples on that show with him. So definitely something you want to hear. And, of course, we'd like to thank CacheFly, CacheFly.com, for the bandwidth. They're a distributed content delivery network, and they do a great job at getting the show from us to you. And, of course, we'd like to thank our sponsors in the podcast marketplace with BB Edit from Bare Bones, as you know, Text Expander from Smile, and Gazelle at Gazelle.com. All right, folks, that's I think, going to do it for this show.
Think so?
I think so.
There must be something we forgot. Now, iTunes comments, always welcome. There you go. I've seen some. Thank you so much.
great afternoon, a great morning, whatever it is you've got going on. And make sure you have fun and don't. I got caught, John. Don't get caught. Don't do what I just did.
Made up.